Hi, I'm Ryan McGranigan, an aerospace engineer, data scientist, and all-around art, design, engineering, and science enthusiast. And you're listening to Origins, the show where we talk with thought leaders across eclectic areas of society about their origin stories and trajectories. The purpose is to highlight these thought leaders across different landscapes, to learn about the pivotal moments in their lives and to illustrate the ways of living that help you actionably re-examine your own assumptions and patterns. To provide ideas and stories to give you pause, bring you excitement, and be origins of new trajectories. Joanne Puttera-Morin is a composer. But the music she writes is more than mere notes. It embraces all of art and science and engineering and finds new frontiers at the intersection of them all. Her music is both song and her research into new modes of immersive, interactive, scientific, and artistic investigation. Through art, as with science, her work seeks to create, as she says, an exponential rise in consciousness. Dr. Puttera-Morin is a professor of media arts and technology and music at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where she has been pushing the boundaries of art and science for nearly four decades. Beginning in 1986, she created, built, and designed the Center for Research in Electronic Art Technology and serves as the center director. She funneled her years of experience in digital media research into a multi-million dollar research program called the Digital Media Innovation Program that is now a beacon for any cross-disciplinary innovation program. She, a composer by training, mind you, served as the chief scientist from 1998 to 2003, a testament to the breadth of her talent. The culmination of Joanne's creativity and research is the Allosphere, a 30-foot diameter, three-story high metal sphere inside an echo-free cube designed for immersive, interactive, scientific, and artistic investigation of multi-dimensional data sets. She serves as the director of the Allosphere Research Facility. Lately, she has been tabbed to lead the effort to determine the trends in arts, culture, and entertainment within the California 100 Initiative, an ambitious project to envision and shape the next 100 years of California. Joanne earned a PhD in 1984 in composition from the Eastman School of Music, University of Rochester. She has been on the cutting edge of digital media and of converging science, art, and engineering for more than 30 years. But she has also pioneered and continues to pioneer education and creating the literacies we need for a changing world. It is a remarkable opportunity to have her teach us here today on Origins. Joanne, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm very honored to be here. And thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. It's been an incredible life for me to be able to engage in what we do here at UCSB and what I do with just the community at large.
Absolutely. There's a theme that I perceived just looking at the body of work that you've done of accessing higher dimensional spaces and kind of the new senses or sensibilities that that requires. And I've been trying to figure out a good way into that theme. And I think that the stories that each of us hold or the stories that you hold with their ability to show us new dimensions might be the right one. And so I want to start by, you know, talking about how the stories we tell ourselves shape us and asking you how you would begin to describe the stories that you hold from your childhood.
Absolutely. Well, that's very interesting because I think from the time I was very young, I knew that I wasn't exactly what I thought I was. It's hard for me to explain, but I can remember lying on the side of the hill. I lived in a very small mining town, and we were Slovak and Italian, but at that time I didn't realize that we were Romani. We lived a very poor life. And I can still remember lying on the side of the hillside of our old house up in Monongahela, Pennsylvania, and I put my hand up into the sky and I could see through my hand like we usually do. I could see and I can still remember saying, I'm me, I'm big and I'm alive. But I knew I wasn't, I guess, what I would call a solid being. I knew that I was more than what I imagined being in in my body was. And so it's kind of been an intuitive search without really even knowing that I was looking for these higher dimensional spaces. It seems as though I had that intuitively in my body, that there was something more than just what I saw with my eyes and felt and heard. And knowing that that was part of the whole reality, but knowing that there were other things beyond what we could see and what we could hear. And I just, you know, went through life very simply. You know, I wasn't going to become, you know, I didn't become learn composition until I was 19 and 20. I was in a rock and roll garage band for a while, and went back to junior college to pick up the keyboard and found musical composition, found a staff paper, found notes. And it was like, oh, and, you know, I was working my way. I was working in two restaurants and just kind of went from there. And it was just an exciting, you know, thing. I mean, I never thought, you know, I was always told, you know, that I wouldn't probably amount to much. And as Janis Joplin used to say, when you have nothing to lose. And I was just on a journey. And the interesting thing is back then, which is hard now for my students, is it was easy to do that in the 70s and the 80s, to be able to go to a public university and afford it by working in a restaurant. That's not the case now. And that's very frightening for me, for the future of equity and diversity.
Very interesting. There's a spirituality in the language you use talking about these experiences as a kid. Do you have a spiritual background to your childhood?
Well, you know, I was born and raised Roman Catholic. But what was very interesting is my mother was tremendously psychic. But it was my mother was very much, torn between knowing our past lives and telling us things and then saying it was just a dream. And, you know, because in, you know, Roman Catholic religion, there's no such thing as reincarnation. So it was a very interesting family that I grew up in. And so, you know, my spirituality evolved from the Orthodox training that I got in that religion to understanding something more than that spirituality is understanding and knowing that the whole universe is alive and that there is, insofar as I'm concerned, a sentience about that, and that we are as I say, you know, I think the big bang or the beginning of this first universe is that, you know, the spirit was asleep. It was alone in a void and it woke up and started to vibrate because it was lonely. And it was just like taking a big mirror and throwing it on the ground and seeing the reflections of all of itself in those little pieces, which are us, and that were these energy coordinate points that are kind of, as Pythagoras used to say in the 6th century, a rock is frozen music in time. So is coming into creation, the deceleration from things that could move faster than the speed of light. And if they could, does that mean that they weren't moving at all? And that nothing is really everything, but not a vacuum. I mean, I'm sorry, I'm putting out there.
No,
it's
a beautiful image that you describe in seeing the reflection of the universe in ourselves. And I think we all kind of oscillate between thinking in these abstract terms and in spirituality, and then trying to bring that into something that we can make sense of in our daily lives and some kind of concreteness. And you titrate between these two poles with a lot of skill, it seems like. And you do that, you've made a career at that. And I'm curious about tracing that, where that comes from in your life. And I think there might be some semblance of it in when you first came to music. When did this mentality start to find concreteness in composition for you? Do you remember a moment or several moments
Well, I can remember writing my first, chord progression on a piece of music. And I'm like, wow, you know, I'd be running around the junior college and people thought it was crazy. Because I'm look, this is 5-1. It makes sound and it's a language and it's not a language where I'm talking in words, but it's something that we all know what that sound is. And, you know, and then, you know, understanding that we do in our Western European world have a particular understanding of this language through sound. But then there are all these other cultures that have these different languages that, are very interesting to me. And it wasn't until I started studying ethnomusicology on top of, you know, composition in my undergraduate, that it was weird. It was like, okay, I've got this language and it's these 12 equal divisions of these frequencies that make an octave. Yet and again, why are those Middle Eastern guys playing all those microtones and where did that come from? And I can remember talking to a linguist at one time and saying, look, you know, we evolve according to, you know, where our culture is. And think about even the different materials that were there to make different sounds, right? And, if you think about us basing things on the Pythagorean theorem and a string that you could put between two, you know, ends and vibrate it, and it vibrates almost symmetrically. I mean, you know, nothing really works that way, but it will vibrate across the pluck point so many times a second for as long as the string is, but then it vibrates twice as fast at a half the amplitude and three times. And it was kind of an integer relationship of these divisions. But when you think about metallurgy and you think about some of the things that, for instance, were there in Java, and when you hit metal, it vibrates like jello. It doesn't vibrate completely uniformly, and you'll get these frequencies that come out as what we call pitches, but there are all these other frequencies. So this started to really excite me about the fact that there were this language that was audio frequencies for me at that time that could be mathematically derived in different mathematical formulas, right? So, you know, I've got, you know, what I'm doing a lot, and that's why I love the quantum so much, especially at the level of the Schrodinger equation, because it's pretty digitized. I mean, it's pretty precise. I mean, you know, the way the quantum numbers work, there are just so many values that you can work with. And that's kind of like, you know, the same thing with the octave in equal tempered tuning. So you can start to map things like what I learned in music, transposition and inversion, into translation and rotation, right? And so the same kind of set and group theoretic principles work across what I knew very well as music into a lot of other sciences. But then you look at my colleague and wonderful mentor in the 40s and 50s, the great composer Yannis Anakis, that started to apply stochastic laws and probability theory in his music and started to understand, you know, the idea of how we could use probability to shape the direction of things that were quote unquote random. In my mind, nothing is really random. It's just too complicated for us to be able to parse it any other way. So that was exciting to me. And by the time I got to graduate school, I realized that there were all these different mathematics that actually were the underpinning of all these different musics.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned Pythagoras. I mean, there's the legend that he finally made the connection between tuning musical instruments by listening to hammers from blacksmiths. And what is kind of this original connection between music and mathematics. I think it ties to something I want to ask you about. You said somewhere, we're all just out there mapping, looking for constructs. I don't know what you mean by constructs. I think it ties into this concept of language, that thinking about it in a more capacious manner. But could you say a little more about what you mean by constructs?
I think mapping is a really important aspect of what we're talking about here, because, you know, how do we perceive the sense of who we are and where we are? I mean, I love, you know, I mean, I feel like I feel ignorant compared to the knowledge that my students have, and teaching them has been absolutely incredible. I mean, you know, my one student that just got his PhD and is Dr. Kanyon Kim now since last Friday came up with, what does it mean to be present? You know, what is presence? You know, how do we know we're here? And, you know, a lot of it deals with the mapping of constructs in, first of all, what he calls, spatial presence, you know, which deals with, you know, some of the unfortunate studies they did on the poor great apes, the neuroscientist, where they would, you know, map sensors and realize that there's this thing called peripersonal space, which is your body schema, and how your arm's reach is what you discern being in a place. And yet, and again, in that space, we're not really looking. It's a very peripheral vision kind of space. It's a space where we grab for things and we can touch things, but we use our vision out from what we call extrapersonal space, what's out there, right? What we can see. So, you know, just even thinking about the constructs of mapping being in 3D, right? And so then how do you take that to 4D? How do you go and take those same things? This is one of what I was saying to my PhD, now Dr. Kim, you know, because he did this mapping with the geometers. They mapped 4D space, these unbelievable vibration equations and all of these things. And, you know, he's like, I can't, you know, because I can't talk about presence in that reality. I said, Kenny, come on. I said, think about it. I said, okay, now let's talk about the difference between spatial presence and social presence. Okay, what happened to the geometers when we started mapping their 4D geometry in the allosphere? And even when we had it in stereo, you know, visual stereo, and we had it on the side, it was deformed, right? But I said, as soon as we brought it overhead, they immediately saw these 4D equations. And in their mind, what they saw from the mathematical equation and what they thought it would look like, it really looked like when they were in the allosphere. And I said, for us, it was beautiful. It was like being in all of these strings that were, you know, like my grandma's crochet. But for them, it was familiar space. They knew that space. They understood that space. So they had social presence in that space when we only had spatial presence in that space. And that becomes very interesting to me. That's why I love so much working with my atomic scientists that are working at the atomistic level. And you know, because you're an astrophysicist, that what happens at the minus powers of 10 is the same thing that's happening at the plus powers of 10, right? So anyway, that's really where these constructs of mapping come. And if we are evolving, I actually believe that we're physically evolving. I mean, I look at pictures of my great grandparents and my grandparents, and they physically look different than I do. I believe the brain is constantly rewiring itself. And I definitely believe after teaching for 37 years, that my students generationally, they're physically, they're evolving. They're much more hybrid, totally more hybrid than I am. It takes, I think, four or five of us that are in the age of the late 60s to teach one of them, because it's very easy for them to go from one sense relationship or to map multiple senses together, where I think, you know, for us, you know, that we're stuck in the discipline, that it's difficult for us to do that. And I think it deals with a rewiring of the brain, which I would certainly love if I can keep my allosphere, you know, as we run out of funding, even as we speak, to try to do those kinds of studies. And the interesting thing is, along with working with these wonderful physicists and these material scientists, I had a very interesting thing happen to me about 6 or 7 years ago, where a Japanese Buddhist monk ended up on the bridge of the allosphere. His name is Danjo-san, and he's very dear to me, a very good friend. And I can remember one of my colleagues bringing him in, actually one of my friends bringing him into the sphere. And he couldn't speak English. And I was like, this is the hydrogen-like atom. It's quantum mechanics, you know, talking, you know, this is the, you know, the electron in superposition. And the one monk was translating to him. And he was standing behind me laughing and tapped me on the shoulder and said something in Japanese to the other monk. And the other monk said, you know, we monks, we know these things like that. And I said, well, you know, I don't know these things. And I'm, you know, not, you know, I said, I'm not enlightened. I need to, you know, do this. And he translated, he goes, don't worry, you will be. And he said, because this is blessed by Buddha. So it's very interesting how, you know, again, you have all of these people, all of these beings that have different constructs in the way that they understand what and who and what we are in the nature of the universe and what it means to be here. And, you know, it seems like us scientists, us artists or whatever, we're always searching. And, you know, we realize that, you know, when you see someone like that, that says, you know, every day is eternity, every day that we are and that we exist in every whatever life or whatever we go through is now, you know, that's what we have. That's who we are. And I think this is, you know, the secret of kind of like what I'm trying to understand. Maybe I'm trying to get to a point where, you know, searching isn't as important as experiencing every possible day and embracing whoever's there and helping who I can help at any particular time. You know, yeah. Anyway, I'm getting very esoteric here.
I love the story about the monk in the allosphere. And I want to come in because we certainly will come back to the allosphere as kind of this culmination of some of these things I want to talk about. I love the story of the monk because as you were describing the construct, the concept of the constructs and mapping, I was thinking about this Buddhist principle of impermanence and how your students have kind of maybe a better sensibility for this impermanence. And I think it comes home right now for all of us in a society, you know, that's having the cracks revealed to us through pandemic and social unrest and these different things and how impermanent a lot of these things that we thought were once stable are, and how the sensibility for living now might be becoming comfortable with uncertainty. And that is that kind of comes back to a very Buddhist ideal of the world. And there's a wonderful book called In Love with the World that I would point everyone to. It has a lot of these ideas really wonderfully spelled out in there. But it also talks about this theme of stability versus freedom or explore and exploit. And I want to backtrack a bit before we talk about the allosphere and some of your other work. You moved to the University of California, Santa Barbara in 1984. I'm curious about the questions that were animating you then. And then I also want to lead into this idea of you've been there ever since. And there's kind of this image of artists and the lives of liminal people that they change and they move around. And I'm wondering if this was a deliberate choice to remain there to create some stability for yourself so that you could be free in other ways.
What's so interesting is, you know, because I'm just a regular human being and my husband, who I've been with, we've been married for about 41 years and we met as musicians at Florida State University. He went off and he's primarily in the blue collar working field. And, you know, we were the kind of people that lived very naturally. My sister lives in Key West, and Key West in the 60s was completely different than Key West is now. people lived almost by the barter system in the 60s back then, and everything was really natural. And I can still remember, you know, I was on this quest of whatever this journey was to find, you know, what I was looking for. 1984, writing my dissertation, which was a 100 voice string orchestra piece, and it was called Tachyons before anybody even knew what that word was. And Star Trek II came out because I was looking for this searching. And, you know, I was looking for job positions, and I had an interview at the University of Pittsburgh and one at Dartmouth and one here at Santa Barbara. And my husband is like, we're not living in Hanover, New Hampshire. We're not living in Pittsburgh. Aren't we going to go back to the Keys? Aren't we going to go, you know, no. And so when I got the Santa Barbara job, he goes, okay, he goes, we're going there and we're not moving. And so that's when I knew that, you know, instead of Mohammed going to the mountain, the mountain had to be brought to me. I knew I was going to stay here. How do I go forward and build what I want to build here and bring this to my students and also bring it to a community and try to help as much as I possibly can to balance this small little piece of the world that I'm in. Okay. So that's kind of, I know I'm getting off on tangents, but that's kind of how I stayed here. And then it became very clear to me that, you know, I mean, look at us here. We're in a bubble. I mean, look at the whole United States right now. Everything is in an uproar. Northern California and, you know, the North is burning as we talk about it. The Midwest and the East Coast is flooding as we talk about it. We got hurricanes coming like crazy through the Gulf. I mean, my gosh, and here we are. Here we are. Always beautiful weather, always fine. We're running out of water. You know, there are problems. But, you know, we're still in a place where we might be able to, because we're not worrying completely about survival right now here. We've got to start to think further along and seeing how we can help in whatever little way we can.
Yeah. So you get to UCSB and you make this the place that you're going to do your work from. And I'm curious how you started to explore outside of your bubble. So you have kind of this musical background. You obviously have this language of spirituality. And how do you start working with scientists? What are the meeting places with those scientists? And do you have to change your language to work with them there?
It's very interesting. I mean, first of all, you know, I had some very forward-looking administrators back then in the 80s. That again hired me as an orchestral composer and threw me in the College of Engineering in 1984. So I started at least working with electrical engineers and computer scientists early on. And they're different than scientists. I mean, it's very interesting when you start to look at the different mindsets. And I learned to communicate with them. And actually, to tell you the truth, I mean, I had one of my colleagues say, why did you make our field of media arts and technology, which I established in 1999. Why did you put together music, visual arts, computer science, electrical engineering? Seems like us artists have more in common with the biologists and the physicists and the people that are working with content. And I said to my colleague, I said, because we're defining a field, a new field that doesn't exist yet. This is a field of digital multimedia. I said, what are the four criteria to me that are important? Definitely, I think if it's digital multimedia, it's easy to see computer science and electrical engineering, okay? Signal processing and programming are going to be an important kind of thing. Why music and the visual arts? I said, and why not geography and why not biology? Now we've got bioengineering and everything. I said, because we're agnostic to the data. Give me biological data, give me, you know, physics, give me whatever. And I can make a general language out of that data that crosses these disciplines. I said, that's why we are together as a team. And if we're the most furthest apart in our cultures, in our thinking processes, where engineers are here and artists are here, if we can talk to one another, then we can certainly engage with those people that we're closer with, the keepers of content, those people that are actually using these tools in order to apply to a specific area of knowledge, right? And so that's kind of how it started in 1999, from the evolution from my Create Center from 84 to 99, to actually building the graduate program, Media Arts and Technology, which reports to, it's very difficult and it's hard to keep it together now, reports to two colleges, the College of Engineering and the College of Letters and Science. So we have two deans. And it's not easy at that point because, you know, it's almost like, you know, having, you know, two parents that don't really have to take responsibility for the child. You know, it's your problem kind of thing.
Yeah, it causes those cracks between disciplines. And that's a very difficult place to be. And I'm curious about the difficult times when you may have felt discouraged or what you have used to kind of sustain yourself in those difficult times. And I'm also, I think this will lead us in, I'm sorry to tag onto this, but just want to, I think this will lead us into the Allosphere. And something I'm curious about is the origins of that as kind of a culmination of some of your creative energy. Was there a failure along the way that led up to the later success?
The whole thing. I mean, what are the difficult times now? Is almost an incredibly difficult time for us because here we've gone from being interdisciplinary back to being disciplinary again. And I've gone through so many different deans and so many different administrations. And, you know, just like the government, you know, just like different areas of policy, people have their own mandates and everybody's very much, you know, believes in what they believe in. And I mean, right now I'm down to like, you know, I've got $5,000 left in my budget to run the Allosphere. And if I don't land another NSF grant soon, you know, I'm not going to be able to keep my PhD group. It doesn't mean that my one stalwart staff from who's a brilliant, brilliant musician, computer scientist, et cetera, that's actually building the open source software is a permanent position that I have. And if it's got to be me and Andres and, you know, and Dennis that push it forward and we educate whatever students we can without any funding to keep them in the graduate research group, we'll keep going forward until they get enough money to deconstruct it. Okay. And what keeps us going forward is this. If I lose the Allosphere tomorrow, I lose nothing. Okay. Because it's a beautiful instrument. We're 20 years at least ahead of everything. And sometimes if you're too far ahead, you know, like who invented energy, Edison or Tesla? Okay. Well, now things are coming out and we're starting to see that maybe if Tesla had won back then, energy would be free. So this is where we are right now. We're at that very, very important edge where, you know, some of my scientific researchers get it. They know we're on to something. They know that when we work together, that we're making headway for them that they couldn't make without us. Yet and again, we're all stuck, okay? Because even though they might have big centers and they're bringing in millions of dollars, half of that money goes to overhead to run the institution. They're desperate to bring in funding to keep their GSRs. It's hard for them to waste their silver bullets and get out of their discipline and partner with a composer to go to National Science Foundation because we can only be co-PIs on a few grants together. So it's become very, very difficult to keep the conversation going forward. The one thing that keeps us going forward is it's taken us now since 2007. I mean, I've been on my own. I received minimal funding support for 12% of a building I brought to the campus. We built the whole thing on our own. We started with two projectors, you know, we're like, hey, you know, Christy Digital, can you help us bring some projectors in? And we built the thing up from the ground floor. It was grassroots. We never wasted a penny. And we're still at that point. And, you know, right now it's very difficult. And if I'm working with an incredible computational material scientist, he's brilliant and he gets it. But it's hard for him as well, because it's very different between the experimentalist and the computational scientist. You know, my experimentalists really don't believe. I've had experimentalists say to me that are working on their microscopes and that they're, you know, on their thing, you know, the computer doesn't generate real information, you know, doesn't give you real data, you know. And so trying to bridge the gap, and we're very close now. We're very close. And once I can get the right model in the hands of the right experimentalists, and I can do that, they're going to say, oh, what they're doing is important. It's worth something. And maybe we should, you know, let it continue. And so that's kind of like where we are. We're on this cusp, like I said, you know, I said, what happens, especially because my students will say to me things like, you know, what is it? Why are some of my professors, you know, just worried about, you know, making their next piece or their next installation? And why do some, you know, seem depressed about the way things are? And then, you know, there's some like you, you know, and I said, look, I said, especially when you get into your late 60s, which most of us are, I said, there's three things that you can do. You can leave your legacy. I said, you can get really depressed about looking and saying, I got 20 years left, maybe on the planet. Or I said, you can jump off the cliff and learn how to fly and look for those hot air currents together. Right. So that's kind of where we are.
I love it. And I think the Allosphere is such a wonderful place to jump off the cliff together, as you say. I will point people to a TED Talk that you gave, a wonderful TED Talk that provided these beautiful visuals of how you visualize and sonify bringing information to sound in this space, this 30 foot high, this huge sphere, this building of immersive technology to explore multidimensional data sets. And I would love to talk to you in more detail about that. I want to, of course, be respectful of your time, so I don't want to go into too much detail here, but I am curious about, it's very difficult to orient ourselves in new spaces. And I'm curious about how long it takes someone when they go into the Allosphere to orient themselves to all of this different sensory input and experience these data in the new way. And I think the connection for me is just, we're all in a new world constantly. And we're all constantly needing to reorient ourselves. And so I think there's a lesson in that for all of us right now.
Absolutely. I think it's because the way that I designed the Allosphere is kind of mini like being on the planet. The Allosphere is not, domes like in a planetarium. What it is it's two tilt dome hemispheres on their side, with a flat spot in the middle, which is a 7 foot wide, 34 foot long bridge. Okay. And it's a capsule. Okay. And it's, and we can be right in the middle of the bridge, and we can be equidistant from all of the data around us. And, you know, when I am in the Allosphere and I put on a equirectangular picture of being like in, the Grand Canyon or something like that, people really feel like they're there and they can acclimate to something that they understand, because they're standing here on a bridge. We've got 4 pi steradians almost of data. We realize again that it's more important in order to know where your body is, proprioception, to have things beneath you rather than on top of you. We don't walk, you know, although you do, astrophysicists, walk outside looking up the whole time. You know, we coordinate through, you know, walking and looking primarily downward, right? And this also deals with this thing that we call peripersonal space and extrapersonal space and how the brain processes information. This is from my Dr. Kim's PhD dissertation, processes information through the dorsal and the ventral streams, where one is used to understand and parse extrapersonal space, which deals with the space that we can't immediately reach or interact with. And that's mainly a visual thing and also auditory because you can localize distance, et cetera, from our peripersonal space, which is much more of a subconscious kind of, you know, a peripheral thing where you're grabbing for things and you're moving and you're walking kind of thing. So to design the allosphere in that way where people feel like it's like how they feel when they're on the planet, and then to slowly tweak them into spaces that they're not used to, I think is the key. Again, it's almost like I learned complex atonal music, right? It's something that one of my other PhDs that's working on, that's bringing the social aspect in, and Padia, what's the ancient form of how we integrate, the Greeks taught, you know, through these epic poems, et cetera, through virtual reality aspects, you know, the idea that in order for us to get to the strange or what we don't understand, we do it by currently using things that we very much understand and then just introducing a little bit more complexity, a little bit more. We train ourselves. I mean, I can still remember a psychologist saying, well, how many sounds do you think you can hear at one time? I said, probably about 100. He goes, that's impossible. I said, no, it isn't. He goes, what do you mean? I go, do you know what we do in the conservatory? And he said, what? I said, it's called ear training. We train our ears. They sit down and we start immediately. They'll give us a piece of staff paper and they'll drop the needle on a piece. And we've got to start to score the parts. Oh, it's sometimes easy to hear the outer parts, but when you start to get all the inner parts, and then you start moving from tonal music, where you can kind of assume the chord progression and what the inner parts do, to atonal music, which is using, you know, 12 frequencies, and then you start moving into, you know, computer music, where you have any frequency that you can hear. So we push ourselves from the familiar to the unfamiliar, and we train ourselves. So I don't know if that explains it.
It does. Well, it reaches to this idea that the way that we the mind works is through metaphors. You know, it's not asking what is it; it's asking what is it like. And so, you know, that's a theory of cognition, is just we think through analogies and metaphors. And I think that's what you're talking about, in this kind of slight tweaking to something to get to the strange or to get to the new. I'm really curious, who's most comfortable when they first walk into the allosphere? Is it physicists? Is it this monk who is in there? Is there a group of people that's more comfortable immediately or more naturally comfortable?
I think the monk was very comfortable when he walked in. I think it's funny. Most people walk in and they're just in awe. They've never been in anything like it before. I bring that to my beautiful, brilliant, research colleagues, you know, Dr. Cabrera and Dennis Atherton and my PhDs, because they know how to make the hard thing about being in virtual reality deals with how you render the 3D. It can be very nauseating if you don't know what you're doing, okay? And my students have gotten to the place, we're probably the only place in the world that can do back-to-back stereo, okay? And what we do is we actually take the stereo information and we map it to math that I don't understand. And if you go all the way up to the top of the sphere, there's no stereo up there. Okay, so you can, for instance, if you're very perceptive, look up, and if a bird's flying or something's flying across, all of a sudden it sticks up there for that 2 feet up to the top. But we've got it so deceptively designed that people actually, there's so much going on. Interactivity is very important. How things move from your extrapersonal space into your peripersonal space become very important aspects of having that feeling of presence, as Dr. Kim said last week in his dissertation. And my students understand the mathematics well enough to be able to do that. So primarily people, I have had very few people that go into the sphere and feel disoriented in such a way that it's unpleasant for them. Okay. Now, before COVID, we would have these end of year shows and would have over 600 people come to see all of our labs and would have everything opened. And I can accommodate kind of, if I squeeze them in, about 40 people on the bridge at the same time. So we'd do shows, right? And, you know, half hour shows through the night, get all 600 people in somehow, you know. And, you know, everyone just is just so enthralled by what they see and what they hear when they go in there. And, you know, we do things where we'll start with rectangular things. You know, you're in the Grand Canyon, non-stereo, you know, now you're in the Luxor Temple, stereo, and you can actually see this thing. And then we'll go on to inner things that are moving. So we go from static to interactive, and people then start to, wow, this is really incredible. And I'll never forget one time I was on the Bridge of the Allosphere, and I was showing the hydrogen-like atom, and we can play with it. People can actually go up to a synthesizer and they can play the quantum numbers, and there's all this stuff happening. And I can remember we were guiding somebody through with a Nintendo joystick. There were 40 people, and only so many people can interact when we're in that way of showing. And there was this woman in the middle of the bridge, and she started yelling out, "Have I been changed? Have I been changed?" And I said, "Can I help you? Can I help you?" And she goes, "I think I've been changed." She goes, "These sounds that I'm hearing, these sounds of the atom," she goes, "I've heard them before." And I said, "That's right." I said, "Because in those times of the night when you're very quiet and you hear these inner vibrations in your body, we're made of these particles." I said, "This is not disconnected from who you are." And, you know, she was just amazed that she felt familiar in this space that was just totally unfamiliar to her. So we've had a lot of different kinds of experiences like that. I only had one person on the bridge go down. And luckily there was a person there that was, you know, that worked on an ambulance. I mean, this person was fine once we got them out of the room. But typically we've got it designed in such a way where, again, we take them from the familiar to the non-familiar. You know, in going in there, what's so interesting is the scientists feel good when they're in their own data. Again, social space, you know, they understand their data when they're in there. Okay. A physicist will understand the Schrodinger equation. A biologist will understand the complex system that we're mapping out there. So that's what's so interesting. People feel they can acclimate when they're in their own data. And so that's kind of a very interesting thing for me. So how do we get people to go from the familiar to the strange from all these different disciplines? Anyway.
It's a brilliant, and I love that you call it an instrument, because it really is an instrument to show people new things and to help them experience things in different ways. So I would encourage everyone to take a close look. You have wonderful videos online and learn more about the Allosphere, because it really can be just an eye-opening educational instrument. And I know we're running short on time, and I want to ask a couple. I have many other questions I would love to ask you, so potentially on a part two sometime. But I want to kind of bring this back to your life. And I'm curious if you have, or what are your daily routines? What does your morning look like to maintain all of the activities that you're doing and kind of the awarenesses that you have, both the very general and abstract and also the, your concrete day-to-day? What is the first few hours of your day look like?
It's just, it depends upon, you know, usually I'm up. I mean, usually I function on about 5 hours, maybe sleep, 4 or 5 hours of sleep. It depends upon what I'm working on. And typically I get up, I have a cup of coffee. Like most
people. What time do you get up?
It all depends. Like, you know, typically I get up, typically if I don't have a deadline that's really important, I get up at about 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, I'd say that's probably good. At 5:45, 6 o'clock, I'm waking up, you know, by seven, I'm, you know, usually in front of the computer trying to parse through things, get my day organized, find out which students I'm meeting with or what projects I'm working on.
Is there any reflection, writing, meditation, other practice that you have early in the morning before you get to work?
I typically, you know, what I do is usually late at night, I put on certain meditation type tapes. One that I love is that I found, which is just absolutely incredible, is it's a very important, it's very weird. It's this, I guess he was clergy and he died like in 1930s or something. And his name was Joseph Brenner. And he wrote a book called The Impersonal Life. And I listened to The Impersonal Life a lot. There's someone that kind of goes through a meditation session that goes through this person's books. And it's about, you know, it starts out with my children, I have come. And I want to let you know that I'm here now. I am in you. I am with you. I am. You are. You know, the only way that I can exist in creation is through you. And so, you know, that thing goes on for about an hour and I usually fall asleep to it. You know, then I wake up in the morning and I try to just go through some time, some quiet time of just kind of like lying there and understanding. I mean, one of the things that, you know, some of the monks have said, because I also have, that Danjo-san runs these meditation seminars now from his monastery in Hiroshima because he can't come over because of COVID. And we'll have 50 people on. This happens at 7 p.m. my time on Wednesday nights. And there's 50 people from all over the world. There are people from, you know, LA all the way to Java on this thing. And, you know, just to understand that the most important aspect, first of all, is, you know, the breath and what that means and how we get to what we call it's this point of time when you don't even realize, and it's actually the point of time in it, when we're creating and when we're writing, we don't even realize that we're not breathing at a particular point of time. It's the breath, what we call the breathless state. It's not like you're holding your breath, but there are these times when, you know, between the inhale and the exhale, that's the point. That's the point that I call is the point of quantum. And for me, in a waveform, it's the zero crossings of the waveform. Okay. It's that time, as I told my material scientist when I said that I believe that we actually experience quantum, you know, and everybody's saying, no, that can only happen at 0 degrees Kelvin, you know, in heavy metals. And now they realize they can hold it in metals, you know, at room temperature. And I said, look, I said, it's like this. I said, the nature of us being in a three-dimensional world is relativity. This is connected to that, this opposed to that. I said, these are two ends of a string. And if you trace the string down to the middle, I find this place that's called the cross. And it's where things, the paradox, they turn into each other. And at this point, everything is nothing because there's nothing to compare it to, but it's not a vacuum. That's the only way I can explain it. And that's the point of stillness. That's the point of what I call not thought state of awareness. The point of where the creative aspect comes from making. So I don't know.
Thank you. I think it's a wonderful reflection to think on that point of stillness. And I am reminded of the Buddhists talk about bardos in life, these spaces in between. And they actually talk about the space between the inhale and exhale as being a bardo. Mm-hmm. You can be attuned to at any time. So thanks for that perspective. So Joanne, I want to be respectful of your time. And I know we're coming up on the end of our time here. So I want to jump to the end of the show. And we typically do a lightning round, which is just a series of four quick questions and answers that we conclude each show with. So, Joanne, are you ready for the lightning round?
I'm going to try.
The first question is very simple. It's one book that you feel has impacted you unlike other people.
Probably Paramahansa Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi and two, Tolkien's Silmarillion.
Oh, fantastic. Number two, what passion outside of your own field has most importantly helped set your trajectory?
Before my back went out, it was running and riding and just doing a lot of physical exercise, that running the mountain, 18 miles high altitudinal.
Fantastic. Number three, what is your latest and most consuming passion? Do you have something that's making your heart sing right now?
Just the work that I'm doing in the Allosphere and how close we're coming to the science and the art trajectory is really exciting to me.
Pushing frontiers, without a doubt.
And my students, seeing them dream.
It's beautiful. And the final question, what is one thing that you have truly and fully screwed up?
Probably being so consumed with my work that I haven't spent enough time with my family and my daughter.
It's a constant push and pull.
Yeah.
Joanne Kutera-Morin, this has been an absolute pleasure, an immense learning opportunity, and just really fun and intriguing to talk with you. So thank you for making time today, and thank you for the important work that you're doing.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It was an honor for me to be here to converse with you. Absolutely. And don't be a stranger. You know how to get in touch with me.
Likewise. And next time when travel opens back up, I will be out at Santa Barbara.
Come to the ball, as I call it. Please come to the ball.
I would love to experience that. Thank you so much, Joanne.
Okay. Thanks a lot. You take care.